This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Once just a radio show, but podcast listeners like you are part of the fastest growing segment of our audience. So thanks for downloading what you might call the Pocket Takeaway. Here's our daily show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Charlotte Elizabeth Diana, the name for the new British royal. Don't touch that dial. Is that news? Healthy, rich couple, has a baby that has little chance of becoming queen. She's got an older brother, remember, George. She's fourth in line to the throne. Is that real news or fake news? The NFL draft. Real news? Fake news. Latest Apple product rollout? Real news or sales pitch? The Dow Jones Industrial Average, economists say this, the Dow Jones Industrial Average all by itself is a completely meaningless statistic, less relevant than fake news shows like Jon Stewart's The Daily Show. Later this hour, a history of fake news and a look at how it has proliferated since Orson Welles sprung the hoax of the century with his War of the Worlds Martian invasion broadcast. But to the real news, and it's about the royals, ones that matter. Changes in the House of Saud, the Saudi Arabian royals, since longtime patriarch King Abdullah died last January, could be profoundly meaningful for the Middle East, and we are already seeing signs of this. Just anointed King Salman turns 80 this year, and he's a king in a hurry. Last week, Salman appointed a new generation of leaders, including naming Mohammed bin Nayef, the interior minister, as crown prince. That means he's next in line for the Saudi throne. A historic move, because Prince Mohammed is not a son of the kingdom's founder, King Abdulaziz. This has happened all while the U.S.-Saudi relationship is in a state of historic transformation, and while the Saudis have launched a war in neighboring Yemen with implications for rising Saudi tensions with Iran. Rare times in Riyadh. Joining us is James Smith, former ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 2009 to 2013. Ambassador Smith, welcome to The Takeaway.
John, good to be with you.
Would you call this rare times of turmoil in Riyadh right now?
In some respects, it is because of Yemen, as you mentioned. On the other hand, I would say that there has been a masterstroke of transition to the next generation, because for decades, people have been arguing that the transition to the next generation was going to create great turmoil within the royal family. But King Salman has effected this change with no emotion and no crisis. So it's a bit of a masterstroke in transition.
In terms of turmoil, you're absolutely right. And of course, Islamic countries have a tradition of succession turmoil. The story of Islam is all about the succession turmoil, which is why there are Shia and Sunni Muslims. But let's talk about the clarity that is potentially represented by the fact that there was no turmoil. The Salman have a very clear idea as to what he wants the next generation to do and where Saudi Arabia is headed right now.
From all of the changes that have been affected since King Salman became king, there are a couple of things that stand out. One is, of the new ministers, most of them come from business and industry and have corporate experience, which indicates that he's looking to modernize the bureaucracy, energize the bureaucracy in such a way that it's never happened before. The second is a transition to a younger generation. And as you mentioned, Mohammed bin Nayef is the current Minister of Interior. Educated in Portland, Oregon at university, very well-respected individual, has worked closely with all elements of our government, and is someone who has a vision for the future in terms of modernization. So there's an indication that the modernization put in place by King Abdullah will be continued. And then as you move to the next generation, even more so. The addition of Prince Mohammed bin Salman as the deputy crown prince and the second deputy prime minister is an indication of support for the younger generation.
What about foreign policy, though? Let's talk for a second about what the Yemen war means in terms of Saudi Arabia potentially confronting Iran. And there are divisions between Washington and Riyadh about this nuclear treaty.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that Yemen is all about Iran, although the public statements are not. I think there are two very limited objectives that the Saudis are focused on in Yemen. Well, one is a shot across the bow to Iran to stop the strategy of destabilization in the region, which is the Saudis' major concern over the nuclear issue. And the second is to halt the advance of the Houthis and in some way cause a conversation between the Houthis and the Hadi government to bring back the Hadi government, probably with the Houthis a part of that, and move back to a sense of stability in Yemen. So I see the air campaign as having very limited objectives with the issue of moving to a political settlement very quickly. The larger issue, of course, is Iran and an Arab coalition that's telling Iran, no more, stop interfering.
We're talking with James Smith, former ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 2009 to 2013. Ambassador Smith, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me today. It was great to be with you.
To find evidence of real change in the landscape of Afghanistan from America's time there, Charles Sennett, founder of the Ground Truth Project, tells us that we must look in smaller places than the vast construction projects that are already joining the rubble of old forts and crumbled monuments from wars past. Foreverstan, Afghanistan on the Road to Ending America's Longest War, looks into the faces of the young people born after 1980 who have known absolutely nothing but war. For them, the fight is for education, especially girls' education, in a country where all the odds are against them.
The Zabuli Education Center outside of Kabul, where we had Beth Murphy, a videographer, spent 3 years, 10 trips there, going and really studying the school and getting to know it very intimately from inside the classroom, and particularly through her relationship with Razia John, who is the founder of the school, who actually lives in Massachusetts, here in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and had this dream of building this school and has executed that.
The day our school opened, there was another girls' school, and because the girls were running around in the courtyard laughing, and some people were passing by, most probably Taliban, and they threw hand grenades, and they killed these girls.
The girls' school there is one of these just portraits of the resiliency of the Afghan people. You see the young girls so dedicated to their studies, defying things like the pressures to be married off at age 13 or 14, and how they're really fighting for their education. And Razia John is taking their side within these very traditional families. We also saw, for example, scenes like one of the administrators at the school every morning tests the well. She takes a ladle and has a big sip of water because the Taliban has been known to poison the wells at these girls' schools. So this sense that these older women, the teachers, the administrators, are putting their lives on the line to educate these young girls really comes alive in the pieces that are part of the project.
Is this why Razia John seems to want the Americans to stay? And we can hear her comment here.
America is never going to leave Afghanistan for many, many years to come. And they will not make the same mistakes as they've made in Iraq.
Is that an expression of faith there from her?
It's a hope. I think her sense is that when the U.S. leaves, great uncertainty will set in, and almost inevitably, the girls' schools will be closed. She has a very powerful phrase, which she shared with Beth Murphy, which is the title of a feature documentary that will be released later this year. And that is, her saying was, no one knows what tomorrow will bring. And in that one phrase, I think you really capture the sense of uncertainty in Afghanistan. There's great hope about the girls' schools that have been built, but there's a real fear that they are more than likely going to get shut down because the Taliban is not giving up. And I think that's the full circle of the Ring Road.
There's a bit of a web of hope here. You found a hopeful connection that's also tragic in the same way between this school and someone in Wellesley, Massachusetts, Patty Quigley, who's a 9/11 widow who serves as executive director of Razia's Ray of Hope Foundation, which is actually supporting this school. Let's hear from her.
I think that we need to be partnering in some way with them. We went in and we destroyed a lot of the country. The country's been in war for almost 50 years now. So how can you expect somebody that only knows war to be peaceful? I think education does that.
How does she connect her experience with 9/11 with what she's doing now, do you think?
I think the connection for Patty is direct, the sense that she had tremendous loss in her own personal life, looking for ways to both heal, but also to find some way for reconciliation, a better way forward. The connection happens between Razia John, who is a seamstress, who's got a wild story all of her own, which Liz Ross tells very well in a radio piece that really ties these two lives together, which was on WGBH. That tie between these two women, Razia John, an Afghan immigrant to the United States who felt terrible after September 11th and who wanted to do something to have the world and particularly America see her country in a different light, really know that it's a place of great culture and a place of great history, and not just a place out of which al-Qaeda set its base and the Taliban ruled. You know, she really wanted to reintroduce America on some level to Afghanistan. That yearning on Razia's part combined with the need to connect on Patty's part, and it brought them together to dedicate many years of their lives to building this school and to building it very successfully. It's a healthy, vibrant school and really producing this generation of young girls who are the first generation in Afghanistan of girls to be educated in a very long time.
And as we can hear from Liz Ross's piece, Patty Quigley really wants it to be sustainable.
You cannot build the school and walk away from it in Afghanistan. You have to stay there and manage it and watch it and make sure that the community feels like it's part of them.
And yet the handover proceeds.
Well, this is the conundrum that I think the whole of America feels, that we know that September 11th was a searing experience. It was an attack on our country. The response in Afghanistan was one that was purposeful. I think it's very different from the war in Iraq that way. And maybe that's why we're still there. I think the commitment holds. Patty put it very well when she said, you can't build the school and just walk away. I think there's a lot of people, not only in the military, in the State Department, and in the White House who feel that way. A lot of Americans feel that way. And I think as we approach the drawdown, which will likely begin to take effect in 2016, where we'll see the 10,000 troops that are there now probably be cut to 5,000. But we keep seeing them pushing it off. Because I think there's a sense here that when the United States leaves, when the international community packs up and pulls out, it's not clear that Afghanistan and the institutions that have been built, including the girls' schools, are actually going to hold together. There's, in fact, great fear that everything will fall apart.
We've been speaking with Charlie Sennett, the founder of the Ground Truth Project, about the series Foreverstan, Afghanistan, and the Road to Ending America's Longest War. The series was produced in partnership with WGBH, includes local reporting from The Takeaway's WGBH producer, Liz Ross. Charlie, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
To learn more about the Foreverstan Project, visit thetakeaway.org or PRI.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Far From the Madding Crowd, the new film based on Thomas Hardy's classic love story, starring Carey Mulligan, Matthias Schoenaert, Michael Sheen, and Tom Sturridge. In select theaters now. Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Moo, working to help businesses stand out with a range of business cards and printed products for telling a company's unique story. Also offering Printfinity, the ability to print a different image on every card. Learn more at Moo.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, and I do try to reply to as many tweets as I can. Thanks for choosing us to listen to. Our motto is share what you know, and there are plenty of ways of doing that. Check us out. Take part in the show. There's more at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And show me your playlist, and I can tell your age. That's right. Not by the number of artists or the age of the artists or if you know the difference between the fifth dimension and One Direction. It's when you stopped updating. That's right. Odds are your little personal archive stopped taking in new material when you turned 33. No, the greatest hits of Pearl Jam purchased last year does not count. The remastered Heart and James Taylor tracks are just nostalgic reflex motions from a dying musical organism, folks. Compiled data from U.S. Spotify users found that at age 33, people stop discovering new music and say things like, Prince is really edgy. I love modern stuff like Counting Crows and Belinda Carlisle. Name something you discovered after you turned 33. Come on.
Hi, this is Charlie Evan calling from Concord, Massachusetts. It's true that I don't get that much new music in my life. I'm 53. But a lot of times the new music I do get is actually things that I heard on NPR. For example, I heard a short concert from Courtney Barnett, who's a singer-songwriter from Australia, that I thought was fantastic. I love you, I hate you, I'm on the fence, it all depends.
Whether I'm up, I'm down, I'm on the bench, and sending on reality. I'm 62, and I never stop looking for new music or music that's new to me. My favorite and best recent discovery, The Bamboos.
From Brighton, Michigan, Janelle Monáe was new to me. I became a fan this year at 53.
Hi, this is Shelley in Michigan. Anything after Katy Perry's Roar pretty much fails to catch my 40-something interest anymore. I used to bite my tongue and hold my breath.
Now, see, I have four teenagers and a five-year-old. In our house, we do Kanye, Katy, Pitbull, Beyonce, Rihanna, all in one minivan.
Hi, this is Kevin Sutton from Dallas, Texas. I'll never stop discovering new music, but then again, I'm a professional musician. I just this week discovered the Bright Light Social Hour. I'm 21 years old, and I try to buy new music by a new band every week, on vinyl, of course.
Hi, this is Holly in Portland, Oregon. I love the question about rediscovering music. Our latest finding, David Jenkins from South Africa in Johnny Clegg's footsteps, well, sort of.
Lawrence, Massachusetts doesn't buy this theory. Definitely not. As a college professor, I am constantly exposed to new and different music through my students. But then there are those who hear something once, and that's all she wrote. From Sunnyvale, California, the last piece of new music I discovered was the Chicago Symphony Orchestra playing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. I was 12 at the time. Sir George Schulte conducting the Chicago Symphony. That is a classic, I'll give him that. Did you stop discovering new music a long time ago, or are you still discovering it? Tell us what new tunes are playing in your earbuds at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Okay, come on, let's work it, people. We've got deadlines, ship dates, closings. Move it, move it, move it, move it.
I don't understand. understand why it's so difficult to confirm an appointment.
I know, I'm so sorry, Miranda. I actually did confirm last night.
The details of your incompetence do not interest me. Tell Simone I'm not going to prove that girl that she sent me. An RSVP, yes, the Michael Kors party. I want the driver to drop me off at 9:30 and pick me up at 9:45 sharp. Then call Natalie at Gloria's Foods and tell her no for the 40th time. No, I don't want duck quads. I want torts filled with warm rhubarb compote.
In the modern workplace, you've got your machine legends, Meryl Streep there, playing the world's busiest human in The Devil Wears Prada, and then you've got those clever, simulated workaholics for whom acting like you're busy is an art.
Yeah. What do you do all day?
Not that much. Uh-huh. I thought that new promotion was supposed to be a lot more work.
Yeah, when the season starts. Right now I sit around pretending that I'm busy.
How do you pull that off?
I always look annoyed. Well, when you look annoyed all the time, people think that you're busy.
George Costanza on Seinfeld, the master of his domain when it came to faking it. Turns out that a lot of people who project a life of 80-hour work weeks are better at acting than they are at their jobs. A Boston University study found that at one unnamed high-pressure global consulting firm, 31% of men and 11% of women gave the appearance of working more than they actually were. Michael Melcher is an executive coach and a partner in the firm Next Step Partners. Welcome, Michael.
Hello.
So we wanted to talk to you because, you know, you've got a little experience in sort of watching this and actually doing it yourself.
You could say that. When I saw the study results, I was not one bit surprised. Right. I think it's quite normal in the work world for people to exaggerate the amount of work they're doing in response to whatever the cultural norms are for what work's supposed to look like.
And in terms of faking, you also substitute the word meeting for maybe picking up my kid at school, that kind of thing.
I actually think the problem, the real problem is somewhat bigger and broader than those kind of extreme cases. I think it's giving the appearance of hard work and long hours for the sake of that when it's not necessarily happening. So there are the extreme cases where people are putting meeting and doing personal things, but there are also the many, many ways that people effectively do personal work or non-work during the work day because they feel that they need to stay really long hours, but it's not sustainable.
And part of this also is sort of getting into the culture. I mean, if the workplace is theater and everybody is acting kind of like an 80-hour a day or 80-hour a week maniac, you acquire the qualities of this frenzy, and whether you need it or not, you're all sort of behaving in a way that projects this workaholism.
That's exactly true, and we're all responsive to the culture. And I think what the study pointed out, which has been established elsewhere, is that men tend to do self-promotional activities more frequently and more effectively than women. So in this case, the version of self-promotion was giving the impression that you're working really long, intense hours. But there are a lot of other ways where that will show up as well.
And the statistics show that in this Boston University study, it was 31% of men and 11% of women gave the appearance of working more than they actually were. Now, this is just at one firm. Are men more inclined to do this because of a certain sort of moral turpitude? Or are women, maybe afraid for their jobs and so maybe are restrained in this kind of behavior? Because I've met a lot of very workaholic women.
Yeah, it's hard to make those kind of generalizations.
Of course.
I think most people are probably pretty honest when it comes to how hard they're working. But I do think that men are sort of trained, if you will, to be more self-promotional, respond to those signals. It's also possible that because women still have more of the caregiving responsibilities, that they have more hard stops. So it's a lot harder to fake when they're stepping out compared to what men might do.
You know, a great study you could do would be to ask the questions of people in these individuals' families, how much they think their parents are working or their spouse is working. Because with flex time, work travels everywhere people go. And if you got a smartphone, I suspect that it would wildly be different from what the actual worker is saying.
Right.
My kids, for instance, probably think I work, 1,000 hours.
Little do they know. What your life is really like.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody is making a kind of accommodation to the demands of the work. And I think most people probably have good intentions. But it's really common now for people to work during the day, go home, see the kids, and then put in some more work in the evenings. But I think the problem is that you have a couple of perverse work systems. One is the billable hours system, where your value is only tied to the number of hours that could be charged to a client, which has all sorts of negative repercussions. That's more like law consulting, those types of businesses.
Right.
The other is the FaceTime system. That's more like Silicon Valley tech companies, where the culture is that you're there 12 hours a day. They have ping pong tables and free food and all that. But all that encourages is a kind of long inefficiency throughout the day, because you're measured by are you there early in the morning and late at night, as opposed to what you're really doing. So what employers really should be doing is finding ways to assess how do we know when you're being productive, and let's look at the results rather than these arbitrary systems that encourage bad behavior.
What's your instinct? Are people likely to be rewarded by just showing up and having extra hours, and does that differ between men and women, do you think?
To some degree, I think that every organization has filters. So there are things we notice and things we not notice. So, for example, some places start late, end late. So if you get there at 7 in the morning and do work, nobody's watching you, and then you leave at 5 o'clock and people think you're a slacker, even if you put more work in. You know, other cultures, they'll value FaceTime meetings, and other ones will look at what your actual productivity is.
There is this anxiety in some workplaces. Nobody wants to be the first one to leave.
Yeah.
Or you wait for the boss or something like that.
Yeah, and the problem is that if you let yourself become prey to that, you can never really be happy, because you probably won't win at the system and your personal life will be a mess. And so people do have to find clever ways to renegotiate these kind of supposed cultural norms just to be sane and happy.
Can management monitor the actual hours of workers without seeming like Big Brother and hugely intrusive or getting a time clock?
I think that Not 100%. I think there are ways that you can actually look at productivity, but there's a saying that what's measured gets valued. So if you're measuring time rather than output, you're going to have a twisted kind of system.
So there's no real progressive way to do that measuring without seeming like a hard...
Yeah, there's no easy way to put it that way.
All right. Michael Melzer is an executive coach and a partner at the firm Next Step Partners. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And you're working. This counts as working.
This counts as work,
totally.
Man.
Totally. Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to post it on Facebook now.
We want to know, have you ever faked it at work to deal with personal matters? Kathleen on Facebook says no. Lucky for you, Kathleen. But does that mean you have an understanding boss or a boss who is also on Facebook? Look out. Have your say. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Once upon a time when broadcasters had very serious and intense voices.
This is Richard C. Hodelet speaking from London. The Allied forces landed in France early this morning.
Richard C. Hodelet, he was one of my favorites. Back then, all news sounded serious, and certainly there were events of the greatest magnitude going on in Europe in the 30s and 40s. But it was a perfect moment for actor-director Orson Welles. War of the Worlds in 1938 was supposed to be entertainment, and not so great entertainment. A radio actor cast in the drama privately told a critic for the New York Daily News, "It'll probably bore you to death." Like this less than exciting music that began the historic War of the Worlds broadcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars.
With that interruption, the real drama began, and by the next day, a media sensation had been created. Headlines declared that the radio play had terrified an entire nation. A generation later, Brad Schwartz was just an undergraduate student at the University of Michigan when the school acquired an archive of thousands of letters listeners wrote to CBS after the broadcast. Schwartz buried himself in the archive for his thesis, and it became a book, Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and the Art of Fake News, published just in time for Orson Welles' 100th birthday.
Essentially, there were two hysterias, basically, that the broadcast caused. The first was the one that everybody knows about, the kind of the momentary fright among a fraction of Welles' audience who did believe the broadcast to be true and were freaked out by it. And they would often write letters even that night saying, you know, it's 9 p.m., your broadcast has just ended and my knees are still shaking, that kind of thing. And they would pour out their experiences to achieve some measure of catharsis, I think, But the next day, once the show hit the newspapers and the press reported that, you know, as one newspaper called it, this tidal wave of terror had swept the nation and all these people, according to the news reports, had freaked out, that's when there was this much larger hysteria where people started to question what this said about their country and about the possibility that democracy could survive in the mass media age. There was great concern about the power of propaganda, and they feared that a dictator or a charismatic individual like a Father Coughlin or a Huey Long could cause similar despotism in the United States if they got access to the radio. And so people poured out in their letters to Wells and the FCC their fears that the radio could topple the American way of government, and that you know, if somebody imposed censorship or if somebody tried to shut down what Wells was trying to say, there would be very negative consequences for American democracy.
How does this merge into public relations press releases that look like, you know, real news, or commercials that look like the set of some news program, but it's not really, and they're talking about, you know, some medical device, doctors say, or even Stewart and Colbert, who, you know, are deliberately imitating news reports and playing on this issue of plausibility because it looks like news. How does this slide into that?
In the 1930s, kind of, we tend to think that there was a firewall between news and entertainment, and in most cases that was true, but there was a very famous, very popular quote-unquote news program on the air at the time called The March of Time. It's where Wells got his start, his big break in radio. And what The March of Time was it was actually an advertisement for Time magazine. They would dramatize news stories. Instead of having an announcer say, this is what President Roosevelt did today, or having a recording of Roosevelt giving a speech, they would have an actor pretending to be Roosevelt, impersonating his voice and saying things that Roosevelt had never actually said, but which fit the news that they were reporting. The March of Time, you know, people heard in the 1930s, they heard the voices of people like FDR and like Hitler and Stalin, all these people were impersonated in the March of Time. They heard those faked voices more often than they heard the real voices. So in a way, the faked voices became the real public personas of these people. And FDR, actually, the White House asked the March of Time to stop impersonating him because, you know, his fireside chats were so influential and his voice was so well known that they didn't want people counterfeiting it and robbing it of some of its power. So yes, when you blur that line between where is news and where is entertainment, you can shape how people see news events and see news figures in a remarkably powerful way.
Back to the letters. Recall a letter, if you can, of somebody who really imagined the world we live in today, maybe who wasn't a conspiracy theorist, but someone who innocently really was able to see to the kind of Twitter era, instant broadcast, instant virality era that you know, you talk about so much and so interestingly in your book.
There was one, I believe it was in the FCC, from a woman who was writing in support of Wells and against the prospect of censorship, and said that instead of having kind of increased government control over what people said over the air, that people needed to assume skepticism within themselves. She actually, you know, she said that if we need to treat everything that comes over the radio as gospel, the two people who are going to love that are advertisers and politicians, because, you know, they use the radio for their advertisements and for political campaigns. And then she said, what we need now is education, not prohibitions. And I think the broadcast will, in time, teach people to view whatever they hear more critically. And that, you know, that seems to be the lesson that a lot of people took from the show. And what I think is the lasting lesson, not just of the panic, if you want to call it that, or the hysteria that War of the Worlds caused, but the larger myth that kind of grew around it of this nationwide panic. If we can always, you know, have that voice in the back of our minds whenever we see an alarming tweet or hear an alarming news story, what if this is another War of the Worlds? You know, is this real? Is the news media getting this correctly? Are they stirring up false fears over something we don't really need to be afraid of? If that's the lesson people take away from the broadcast and from the book, I think I've done my job.
Brad Schwartz is the author of Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, and The Art of Fake News. Thanks so much, Brad.
It's great to be here.
To hear more from Brad Schwartz, download our podcast. You can subscribe by going to iTunes or any service you use to get your podcasts. In today's episode, Brad Schwartz shares some of the other scares since the War of the Worlds that have sent societies into panic, including one ominous tweet that suggested the White House was under attack. Check it out on our daily podcast.
They'll say, Thomas Edison, he's the man to get us into this century. And that man is me.
And here's something to take with you today. It turns out that in addition to everything else he invented, Thomas Edison came up with Chatty Cathy, the talking doll.
Oh, Chatty Cathy, oh, Chatty Cathy, oh, Battelle's famous talking doll. We pull the ring, and you say 11 different things. Let's play house.
That's the Chatty Cathy from the 60s. Edison's weren't called Cathy, but they did talk with his brand-new crankable grooved cylinders, brand-new in 1890. The spooky-looking Edison dolls were a commercial flop, but for collectors they are extremely rare. Now, advanced sound imaging technology developed at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory allows people to hear the long-degraded sounds from the cylinders inside the dolls. The Edison estate claims they may be the first entertainment recordings ever made. A little girl reading this poem. There was a little girl, and she had a little curl right in the middle of her forehead. When she was good, she was very, very good, but when she was bad, she was horrid. You're not horrid. You're a Takeaway listener, and you can ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints. I do my best to get back personally to you to respond. Tweet me your questions at Jay Hockenberry, and if you want to take the Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.